Да здравствует 60-я годовщина Великой Октябрьской социалистической революции! Да здравствует героический советский народ и его доблестные вооруженные силы! Слава Коммунистической партии Советского Союза, руководящей и направляющей силе советского общества! Ура!
Listening to Back in the USSR, you're on 93.3 FM, CFRU. I am Siegfried. And one of the major subjects that I've talked about recently is the expansion of the BRICS. This international economic partnership, originally between Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, which has now expanded to include Egypt, Iran, Saudi Arabia, Argentina, and Ethiopia. You know, it's one of the biggest, you know, economic and political developments in recent history. You know, this expansion of this alliance, which is really encompassing numerous countries around the world that are large economies, emerging economies. And this economic bloc increasingly dominates the economic landscape in the world. And all these countries are non-Western. You know, they're not in Europe, they're not in North America. They're in South America, Africa, and Asia. And numerous factors, especially the warlike posture that the U.S. has taken with regard to China and Russia, you know, in Ukraine and Iran, you know, the conflicts there, you know, increasing tightening of sanctions on Russia and China, and the disruption they've caused to global trade flows and the fear that similar sanctions could be visited on other countries. They've driven the BRICS countries, including these new arrivals, which includes several key U.S. allies, to move away from the U.S.-dominated global economic system. And with these countries increasingly interconnected economically and using their own currencies for trade instead of the U.S. dollar, the longstanding global reserve currency, you know, the U.S. dollar has been dominant for decades. You know, it's been the, you know, more than 90% of global trade being conducted in that one single currency. But these countries are increasingly not using that currency. They're not using the U.S. dollar, and they're increasingly steering clear of institutions like the IMF and the World Bank. So big changes are coming internationally, you know, economically, politically, including for those of us living in North America. And I want to stress that because in Canada, we often think of ourselves as somehow insulated from international developments. And that whatever happens out there, you know, the impact on us is going to be soft, right? We're insulated from all that stuff. We've got, like, you know, we're in such a privileged position that none of this kind of stuff is going to help us. But if the U.S. dollar and the U.S. economy, which the Canadian economy and the Canadian dollar are, like, basically pegged to, you know, they're really joined at the hip. If the U.S. dollar and the U.S. economy lose global supremacy, which is now all but certain with the expansion of the BRICS and the inclusion of all these massive economies in the BRICS, increasingly trading in outside the American-dominated economic order, it means that the U.S. and the Fortune 500 companies will not be in a position to exploit foreign markets, labor, natural resources, etc., in the way that they become accustomed. You know, in all these decades that the U.S. has been on top, that, you know, dominating the world, you know, all these companies, you know, you have, like, exactly, you have IBM, General Electric, all these kind of companies. Then you have, you know, Monsanto, Microsoft later on. Now you got companies like Tesla and Amazon and all these corporations. They've been accustomed. They've gotten used to being able to go into foreign countries, dictate terms to those countries, you know, exploit natural resources, exploit markets, exploit labor on their terms, not on the terms of those countries. And they become accustomed to drawing massive profits, you know, windfall profits out of that arrangement, that dominant position that they occupy. That's increasingly not going to be the case. You know, they're going to have to play ball with an economic order that is multipolar, involving all these different players. You know, the U.S. isn't going to be on top. It's going to be one player among many, not the boss of the system. And the same goes for the likes of, like, say, Amazon or Microsoft, you know, U.S.-based companies. They're going to have to play ball with many, many different competitors in a world order where increasingly countries are going to be exerting their sovereignty and negotiating for a better deal for themselves as countries, as sovereign nations, as opposed to just being bullied into accepting whatever the companies or whatever the corporations want, whatever terms that they want to dictate. It's not going to be like that anymore. And that's amazing news for global South countries. You know, in South America, Africa, Asia, that have been exploited for decades by U.S. and Western corporations and had their lands and resources stolen and exploited, often in conjunction with brutal military violence by Western countries. You know, if you look at Libya, you look at Iraq, you look at Syria, you look at, you know, Panama, former Yugoslavia, all these places, multiple countries in Southeast Asia. You know, and that's not even including all the countries that have suffered U.S.-backed coups, like in Chile and the like. But, you know, in addition to these changes in the global South, you know, where all these countries are going to be able to, their sovereignty is going to be much more intact. They're going to be able to exert much more control over themselves economically and politically. in addition to those changes, those very positive changes, there's also going to be major domestic changes in places like the US, Canada, and the UK. You know, and basically all these other European countries as well. All these countries which have grown used to being the dominant global players, and which they will no longer be. Countries which are not used to being one amongst many. You know, like or to have to stand amongst equals. They're not used to that. They're used to being on top. They're used to being in control. And when Western corporations cannot reliably exploit foreign markets, labor and natural resources to make windfall profits, they're still going to be able to go into foreign markets. They're still going to be able to make profits, but not to the degree that they're used to. They're not going to have the kind of profit margins that they're used to. You know, if they go into these countries and like have to kind of negotiate on terms which benefit the actual country itself and its people and its government, and have to subject themselves to greater regulation and come to terms with the locals instead of being able to dictate terms which are favorable to the company but not to the people, the profits they make are going to be smaller as a result. You know, they won't be able to as reliably exploit foreign markets and just go in there and take whatever they want. They won't be able to do that. And so what are they going to do as a result? They are increasingly going to turn to the domestic population in Canada, the States, Europe, and they're going to super exploit workers in these countries. They're going to super exploit workers at home. They're going to super exploit domestic labor, markets, and natural resources to try to claw back the profits they can't make anymore. In the global south, they can't make these profits anymore by going to Asia or Africa or South America. They can only do it increasingly by imposing their will on working class people here. And they're going to be able to do whatever it takes to maintain these profits. And this is where fascism becomes a real possibility. You know, I'm talking like fascism in North America and in Europe, you know. I mean, fascism as it appeared in places like Italy and Germany during the last century is a response to a weakening of the capitalist system in those countries. I mean, Germany lost its colonial empire after World War I, whilst Italy barely had any overseas dominions to speak of apart from Libya and Somalia. You know, it was really late to the game when it came to dividing up Africa in the late 19th century. Italy barely had anything, you know, any overseas possessions. And capitalists in both countries were also facing rising working class resistance. You know, really, really strong socialist movements in both countries. There were, you know, rising calls for socialist transformation. There were rising labor costs as workers demanded more. They demanded better. They weren't going to work for like starvation wages anymore. The companies were also facing diminishing profit margins and also diminished international market share. You know, they weren't as competitive on the global scene anymore, which is the same. And the same thing is going to happen with US companies. They're going to be less competitive on the global scene. They're going to have a less market share. They're not going to have those guaranteed profits from overseas anymore. You know, so all those challenges which were faced by capitalists, by employers in Italy and Germany between the wars in the 20s and the 30s, all of these are, you know, with the diminishing international market share, diminished profit margins, working class resistance, you know, rising labor costs, all this stuff, all these are challenges that the US capitalist class is facing now. You know, even if calls for socialism have died down in recent years, you know, you have increasing working class resistance in the United States. You have the United Auto Workers. They're about to go on strike. And I just heard today, actually, that Elon Musk has apparently already removed them from Twitter as a result. you know, this billionaire trying to basically like silence the strikers and like prevent them from like spreading their message, getting their message out on social media, you know, so like this kind of feeds into what I'm talking about here. You know, the employers, the bosses kind of getting increasingly worried. And I mean, UPS workers, they successfully went on strike in the summer and they got what they wanted. They got a really good deal. They got rid of like two-tier hiring practices and stuff. And like they got the benefits which they had fought for years. You know, they got them all. They won a major victory. So, and there's every indication that this resistance is growing. There's going to be increased unionization. There's going to be increased push for unionization. In North America, in Canada, in the US, you know, in the private sector, you know, there's workers are increasingly fed up with neoliberalism. They want a better deal for themselves and they're fighting for it. And this resistance is growing even as US economic and political power declines globally. You know, and the share of economic power globally by US companies is declining. So it's along with their profit margins. And it's at times like this when fascism raises its ugly head. You know, and this is, we have to stress this. Fascism, and this is where people go wrong on fascism a lot. They just see it as political repression. If there's any political repression anywhere, that's fascism. Any censorship, whatever. And it's like, that's not the case. Fascism is a very particular set of conditions. It comes out of a very particular set of conditions that give rise to a particular politics, which is designed to secure capitalism at a time when capitalism is declining and where the threat of radical change is increasingly real. You know, say like in Italy and in Germany in the 1920s and 30s, it looked very likely that there was going to be a socialist revolution. And the bosses were getting shaky and scared by this. And so, well, they turned to some very unsavory far-right forces as a result. Far-right authoritarian forces that were not afraid to repress and to kill and to censor and to crush labor unions and repress social movements and the like. They turned to those political forces to secure their own interests and their own profits. And this is the very real threat that working class and oppressed people in North America and Europe face today. Fascism is capitalism in decay. Fascism is capitalism in decay. And this is the reality that we're increasingly going to face in these Western countries, which are, you know, used to being on top, used to being the dominant players globally, you know, politically, economically, militarily. They no longer are. And they're increasingly going to turn inward with the repression that they, for a long time, expressed outward. And they were repressing people overseas. They were repressing people in developing countries in the global south, trying to steal resources, trying to exploit labor down there. Now they're increasingly not going to be able to. So what are they going to do? They're going to come home. They're going to come home and all that repression is going to be directed on workers here. And we got to be ready for that. We got to be ready to resist that. And it's going to be hard. It's going to be hard, but this is where things are trending, you know, and I believe that we're really going to need workers are here really going to need international solidarity increasingly. They're going to have to look to the global south. They're going to have to look to these countries, which they maybe never thought to look to before, you know, and people like the United Auto Workers and these kind of people, they're going to have to look to their brothers and sisters down south, you know. It's going to be crucial for them in the struggles going forward. There can't be, working class people cannot afford to have borders divide us, because increasingly those borders are going to get raised. They're going to be emphasized more. There's going to be a lot of emphasis on patriotism and really militant and fascistic forms of nationalism are going to be pressed down. And the only way workers are going to be able to resist that is through international solidarity globally. So to drive this point home a little more, I want to play Michael Parenti's talk, The Functions of Fascism. I believe he gave this talk back in the 90s, but it's absolutely relevant today because we really need to understand, brothers and sisters, comrades and friends, we really need to understand what we're getting into here. the kind of reality, the kind of world that we're going to be facing. It opens a lot of possibilities, a lot of new possibilities for working class people everywhere as U.S. hegemony fades and the empire no longer controls everything and can't repress people all over the world like it used to. But at the same time, it also brings about a lot of threats. You know, this world also, you know, a lot of dangers. Whereas as this empire declines, the most reactionary elements in Western societies are going to assert control. And they're going to be backed and encouraged by capitalist forces that want to maintain their profits at any cost. And really, they don't care about democracy. They will gladly throw democracy to the winds in order to secure their profits. And the kind of lifestyle, the kind of wealthy way of life that they're used to. You know, obscenely wealthy way of life that they're used to. They will absolutely turn, as working class, as ruling class classes have throughout history, they will happily turn to dictatorships and mass repression and whatnot when, in order to secure their class interests when the chips are down. So keep that in mind as we listen to Michael Parenti's talk, The Functions of Fascism.
This is Michael Parenti, and welcome to Real History, a series of talks by me on different historical subjects that are relevant for understanding today's realities. Most people are never exposed to real history. In school, we usually don't read history, we read history textbooks, and mainstream ones at that, which avoid underlying realities, and ones that propagate myths that serve the powers that be. Myths that some of us find harmful to the truth and to democracy. So this is real history. This particular segment is entitled The Functions of Fascism. Fascism is a name that was given to the political movement that arose in Italy under the leadership of Benito Mussolini, who ruled that country from 1922 to 1943. Nazism, a similar movement led by Adolf Hitler, was Germany's dictator from 1933 to 45. It's considered by most observers to be a variant of fascism, as to a lesser degree is the militaristic government that controlled Japan from 1940 to 45, and the Falangist movement led by Francisco Franco in Spain, when the fascists there, with the military aid, by the way, of the Italian and Nazi fascists, took over after a protracted civil war. There are similar fascist or self-avowed fascist movements, but less successful ones arose in Eastern Europe and in Great Britain, the United States, France, and other Western industrial nations. Movements. Some of them also came to power. We might recall today when the press is full of news about how Bulgaria or Romania or Hungary or Lithuania are returning, or Poland are returning to their democratic roots by overthrowing communism, we might recall that they weren't democratic before communism came in. They were fascist. In fact, several of those countries, with the exception of Poland, were open allies of the Nazis. They were Nazi fascist allies. Now, like with a lot of terms, like liberalism, democracy, socialism, communism, no single definition of fascism maybe will satisfy everybody. And with fascism, there's a really special problem because it's a beguiling mix of revolutionary-sounding mass appeals and reactionary class politics. And the reactionary class politics are the part of fascism that our establishment historians, almost never talk about. Hitler's party, for instance, was called the National Socialist German Workers' Party, the NSDAP, or Nazis. It's a very left-sounding name, National Socialist German Workers, and it was designed to win broad support among working people, even while the Nazis were destroying working-class organizations. In other words, fascism, the original Italian and German variations of fascism, was a political phenomenon that made a revolutionary appeal without making a revolution. It promised to solve the ills of the many while in fact protecting the special interests of the few with violence and terror. And it propagated a new political consciousness, a new order, a new nation to serve the same old capitalist system. Let me run down a couple of the major characteristics of the fascist ideology. First, there's a glorification of the leadership cult. the commitment to an absolutist and supreme leader, all-knowing, all-guiding, the Führerprinzip, as it's called, the Führer principle, the leader principle, I should say. Second, there's a glorification of the nation state as an end in itself, as an entity unto itself, an absolute component to which the individual is subsumed. Everything in the state, everything for the state, nothing outside of the state. That was Mussolini's dictum, and it was Hitler's also. In fact, with Hitler, Rudolf Hess once said, Adolf Hitler is Germany, Germany is Adolf Hitler, therefore combining both the leadership cult and the state cult in one. Third, there was a glorification of military conquest and jingoism, the glory of that the state is vitalized by subduing, conquering, taking other people, enslaving them. You increase your own power and your own glory. Fourth, there was the propagation of a folk mysticism, a xenophobia and a racism. The Nazi slogan was Ein Volk, ein Reich, ein Führer. One people, one state, one leader. Also, as a other side of the folk mysticism and this blood cult of the special blood, the special legacy, the atavistic wonders of our particular people, was a xenophobia, a hatred and a racism, a hatred of other peoples, other nationalities. With the Nazis and with most other Eastern European fascists, it was anti-Semitism. The Jew was seen as the perpetrator of all that was ill in society. The trade unionists, they were Jews. The communists, so forth and so on. And behind them stood this wicked, alien-blooded creature who would undermine our state. Fifth, there was an opposition, both in Italian fascism and in German Nazism, an opposition to socialism, to communism, to anarchism, and to all left egalitarian class movements and doctrines, along with opposition to trade unions, opposition to labor parties, opposition to other working class political organizations. Of these various characteristics of Nazism, 1, 2, 3, 4 are often talked about by established historians and mainstream historians. That last one, though, opposition to labor unions, opposition to working class parties, opposition to socialism and such, that one is never talked about by Western writers, especially American writers. The historians and the political scientists and the journalists who treat the subject of fascism usually write from a centrist ideological perspective, from the political center of the spectrum, which means they usually ignore the link between fascism and capitalism, just as they tend to ignore the entire subject of capitalism itself when there's something unfavorable to say about it. Instead, they dwell on the more phantasmic components of fascist ideology, the nihilistic revolt against Western rationalism and individuality, the irrational appeals to mass submission to a leader and all that. And fascism was those things, but along with its irrational appeals, it had rational functions. It was a rational instrument for class domination and for the preservation of the existing capitalist system. After World War I, Italy had a parliamentary government that seemed really incapable of solving the country's economic crises. Profits were declining, banks were failing, unemployment was rising. So to ensure profits, the big industrial giants and the big landowners would have to slash wages and raise prices. The state, in turn, would have to provide the big owners with tariff protections along with massive subsidies and tax exemptions. To finance this, the population would have to be taxed more heavily, their wages rolled back, and social welfare expenditures drastically cut. It sounds like Reaganism. Well, it is, even more extremely so. But the government wasn't totally free to apply these harsh measures. First of all, Italian workers and peasants had their own unions, they had political organizations, they had cooperatives, they had their own publications. And through the use of demonstrations and strikes, boycotts, factory takeovers, occupying farmlands, the forcible occupation of farmlands, they often won some very real concessions in wages and work conditions, unemployment benefits, and they won the right to organize. But the government wasn't totally free to apply these harsh measures. First of all, Italian workers and peasants had their own unions, they had political organizations, they had cooperatives, they had their own publications. And through the use of demonstrations and strikes, boycotts, factory takeovers, occupying farmlands, the forcible occupation of farmlands, they often won some very real concessions in wages and work conditions, unemployment benefits, and they won the right to organize. And even in the face of this worsening economic crisis, they were able to mount a troublesome defense of their standard of living. I mean, troublesome for those who own the land, the labor, and the capital, and the money in the banks, and the farms, and the factories. So the only solution really was to smash the worker and peasant organizations, in effect destroying all political and civil liberties, including the right to organize, agitate, and propagandize. The state would have to be more authoritarian and more firmly subservient to the interests of capital. Mussolini and his black shirts were around right after World War I, and for about 3 or 4 years, the big landowners and industrialists used their fascist goon squads, gave them money and gave them arms, and used them as kind of strike breakers, anti-labor militias. They styled themselves the United Front Against Bolshevism. In 1922, the big capital interests in Italy decided to go for the whole thing. Representatives of the Federation of Industry and the Federation of Agriculture, which was a agribusiness firm, and representatives of the National Banking Association, they all met together, and they met with Mussolini, and they planned the fascist march on Rome. Mussolini sat there and planned that with the leading capitalists of Italy. By the way, this is almost never mentioned in the accounts about the March on Rome. These big capitalists contributed 20 million lira toward that undertaking. In the words of Senator Ettore Conti, himself a very loyal representative of the moneyed interests, quote, Mussolini was the candidate of the plutocracy, that is, of the wealthy, and the business associations. A very similar pattern, by the way, of coordination and compliance existed between in Germany also, less than a decade later. German workers and farm laborers in the period following World War I under the Weimar Republic won some important economic concessions. They won an 8-hour day, they won unemployment insurance, they were able to elect shop committees, and they won the right to unionize. And again, during the 1920s, these paramilitary right-wing gangs, most notably Hitler's brown shirts, stormtroopers, were subsidized by business in a limited way and kept as a kind of reserve army, what Guérin called the bodyguard of capitalism. And their job again was to strike, break, and to harass, organize workers, and to beat up socialists and communists and such. The nearly total collapse of the German economy in 1929-30 presented the owning class with a momentous crisis. They had very big capital investments, and these left them with very high fixed costs that had to be met even as their plants lay idle. Only massive state aid could revive their profits. Wages and social welfare, human service expenditures had to be cut. Union contracts had to be abrogated. In fact, human contracts had to be abrogated too. Business would need new subsidies and tax exemptions. The crisis in agriculture was equally severe, and the large landed proprietors, Junker class demanded even higher subsidies, heavier duties on foreign agricultural imports, and an end to farm unions. These unions were holding wages up, and when wages were being sustained, you cut into profits. So by 1930, most of the influential landowners and big industrialists and bankers, especially the industrialists in steel, coal, and mining, had concluded that the Weimar Republic no longer served their interests, and no longer could protect their class, and that it was too accommodating to the working class and to certain sectors of light industry. So they greatly increased their subsidies to Hitler, and they propelled the Nazi Party onto the national stage. By 1930, most of the great industrialists and bankers were underwriting the Nazi Party. And what happened in 1930 with this injection of hundreds of millions of marks is that Hitler was able to catapult his party onto the national scene. It went from a cult of brown shirt thugs to a national party mobilized. In the election of 1930, the Nazi Party gained 107 seats in the Reichstag. And Hitler, later on, evoking the memory of what he called that astonishing campaign, told his listeners to think of, quote, what it means when 1,000 speakers, each has a car at his disposal and can hold in a year 100,000 meetings. And in 1931 and 32, the subsidies from the big industrialists continued to grain in ever more abundantly. So the Nazis were projected onto the national stage, and they gained an ever larger presence in the Reichstag. Neither in Italy nor in Germany was revolution really something that was in the offing. I mean, it wasn't a real threat. The left was never strong enough to take state power in either of those countries. So the threat wasn't really from the left. The bourgeoisie resorted to fascism less in response to the disturbances in the street and more in response to the disturbances in their own economic system. The threat wasn't from the left. The threat was from their own economic systems and its contradictions, and the fact that democratic forces had developed enough democratic strength to resist the austerity and the rollback that the capitalists tried to impose to maintain their levels of profit. The sickness that these capitalists tried to banish was from within, not from without. The Italian and German monopolists, the big cartels, also had a direct interest in an expansionist military regime. They wanted a big rebuilding of the military, one that would, one, compensate, first of all, would compensate for the decline in investment opportunities with huge armament contracts and related public works. In other words, this industrial and financial class wanted a large defense budget, as we would call it, because it was a source of capital investment and enormous capital profits. Does that sound familiar? Two, they wanted to embark on an aggressive foreign policy to open new markets for export and investment, thereby gaining a more equal footing with French and English competitors. So the fascists really became a very valuable ally against the capitalists' two worst enemies. The capitalists' two worst enemies are, first, the workers in their own country, and the capitalists of foreign countries. And the genuineness, by the way, of fascism's hatred of workers and foreigners was never open to doubt, so they fit in quite snugly. Now, I don't mean to say that all the big industrialists and financiers supported fascism with equal fervor. Some, like Tyson, were early and enthusiastic backers of Hitler. The aged Emil Kerdorf thanked God that he lived long enough to see the Führer emerge as the savior of Germany. Others contributed money to the Nazis, but also to other anti-socialist parties on the right. They backed Hitler only when he promised to be the best hope for their interests. By the way, many of them still remain privately critical of the more extreme expressions of Nazi propaganda, and they were a little uneasy about the anti-bourgeois rhetoric sometimes used by some of the fascist plebeian elements. They backed Hitler only when he promised to be the best hope for their interests. By the way, many of them still remain privately critical of the more extreme expressions of Nazi propaganda, and they were a little uneasy about the anti-bourgeois rhetoric sometimes used by some of the fascist plebeian elements. Some elements in business were not that hot for fascism. Light industry, which had lower fixed costs and more stable profits than heavy industry that was dependent on consumer buying power and such, the light industrialists were not that keen about a more aggressive foreign policy, about heavy subsidies to heavy industry and the like. But when push came to shove, they may not have been close to the fascists, but they weren't about to ally themselves with the proletariat against the business class of which they were a part. And they pretty much sided with the dominant elements or kept their mouths shut. There was another element in these two societies that not only tolerated the rise of fascism, but supported it. And I'm talking about the parliamentary capitalist state itself. Not the government or the parliament as such, but the instruments of the state, the instruments that have the legal monopoly on force and violence, the police, the army, the courts, and the like, the secret intelligence agencies and such. In both Italy and Germany, years before Mussolini and Hitler emerged victorious, these elements, courts, police, the army, showed a real leniency and an open collaboration with fascism while harshly repressing the left. Mussolini and Hitler could not have come to power without the help of the state machineries. and that state machinery was never really against him. In Italy, the police collaborated with the fascists in attacking labor and peasant organizations. They recruited criminals for the fascist action squads, the squadristi, as they call it, squadristi. They promised them immunity from prosecution for past crimes. When applications for gun permits were regularly denied to workers and peasants, police guns and police cars were made available to Mussolini's goons. Germany, the same kind of thing went on. Immediately after the war, the military police and the judiciary sided with the rightists to suppress the left, a pattern of collaboration that continued to the day that Hitler took power. In other words, these supposed democracies, which were equally opposed to totalitarianism of the left and the right, were not equally opposed. They were opposed to the left, and they were very close and comfy with the right. Because the right, while it was out to destroy that democracy, the right was protecting the interests of property and the existing class structure. And that's the difference between the left and the right, and that's why a capitalist state tends to treat the right so much more leniently and the left so much more harshly. Let's look at what happened by the police and the courts under the Weimar Republic. These are the figures. Left-wing groups were charged with 22 murders. 38 people on the left were found guilty for those 28 murders. They averaged 15 years in prison. 10 of those 38 were executed. Among right-wing groups, 354 murders. What is that? That's about 60 times more the number of murders. Of these 354 murders, 326 were not even prosecuted. 23 were discharged. 23 people of the right-wing groups were discharged despite entering guilty pleas. They pleaded guilty to the murder and they were discharged. 24 were found guilty in part. Their average term in prison, 4 months. The number of them executed for the murders? None. So that's the way the state operated. Almost all the literature on fascism and Nazism concentrates on who supported Hitler, who supported Mussolini, who was behind him. Was it this group or that group and such? Oh, there was a couple of millionaires who didn't like them. Oh, there were some workers who did vote for them. So you can't really say it's one class or another. Well, I think you could pretty well say which class gave them the money, that gave them the visibility, the organization, and the numbers to some degree. But there's something else. Besides talking about who supported fascism, one thing these historians and political scientists never talk about is who did fascism support when fascism came into power? Who did the fascists support? Well, in Italy and Germany, when they came into power, they began implementing the stern measures that were needed to rescue the capitalist economy. Labor unions were dissolved. Strikes were outlawed. Union contracts were nullified. Prominent union leaders and other labor activists were imprisoned or murdered. Union property was confiscated. Worker publications were banned. Opposition political parties were outlawed. Their leaders jailed. Civil liberties were suspended. Fascist-sponsored unions, quote, unions, were set up, and their function was to speed up production, prevent wildcat strikes, and apply punitive regulations, including fines, dismissals, and imprisonments against workers who agitated or complained of shop conditions. I mean, even a Nazi labor front newspaper had to admit, quote, some shop regulations are reminiscent of penal codes. Workers no longer had the right to change jobs. They could be shifted from one employment to another regardless of their wishes. They could be conscripted for any work assumed useful to the nation's economy without guarantee of wages equal to previous earnings. In both Italy and Germany, the government exercised compulsory arbitration and regulation of work and wages. By the way, any worker who contested that would be contesting the laws of the state and therefore would be declared an enemy of the state, not just in conflict with management, but an enemy of the state. And so, in effect, what you got was a perfect wedding of the interests of the state and the interests of the capitalist class in this particular capitalist state. And by the way, these measures had their effect. According to figures supplied by the Italian press itself, the already meager wages, you know, the wages weren't all that good to begin with, for Italian workers in 1927 were cut in half by 1932. By 1939, the cost of living had risen 30%, and this constituted an additional decrease in real wages. Taxes on wages were introduced. Regulations were instated against minimum wages. The minimum wage law was abolished, in other words. There was no more increased pay for overtime. In some regions, sanitary and safety regulations were dropped. Occupational safety regulations were eliminated in factories. In many areas, child labor was reintroduced. In other words, all the old abuses and old evils that the Italians thought were dead, that were belonged to a generation ago, had returned under fascism. In Germany, the same story. Between 1933 and 1935, wages were lowered anywhere from 25 to 40%. That's a tremendous cut if you're an ordinary worker just trying to make ends meet. Wage taxes were instituted. Municipal poll taxes were doubled. Payroll deductions helped finance the Nazi-controlled labor front. And the Nazi labor front controlled the party organizations and the health and unemployment insurances, all of which, by the way, lowered wages another 20 and 30%. That is, the things that were taken out of your pay for that. And the non-profit mutual assistance and insurance associations that had existed before the Nazis came to power and the free labor unions were abolished. Their funds were taken over by private insurance companies that charged more while paying out smaller benefits. So, and in Italy, in Germany, just like in Italy, inflation substantially added to the German workers' hardship. There's something else both of these fascist leaders did. In both Italy and Germany, the process of privatization. Does that sound familiar? Ronald Reagan's dream. State-owned enterprises such as power plants, steel mills, banks, railways, insurance firms, steamship companies, and shipyards were handed over to private ownership for a song, like gifts. Corporate taxes were reduced by half in both Italy and Germany. Does that sound familiar? Another Reagan achievement. Taxes on luxury items for the rich were cut. And inheritance taxes were either drastically lowered or abolished, just as they've been the last 10 years in America. And inheritance taxes were either drastically lowered or abolished, just as they've been the last 10 years in America. In Germany, between 1934 and 1940, the average net income of corporate businessmen rose by 46%. Enterprises that were floundering were refloated with state bonds. They were recapitalized out of the state treasury, and they were returned to private control when solvent. So you see, these are people who say socialism doesn't work, but when capitalist businesses start to fail, they go socialist. They take the money out of the public treasury and refloat these businesses. Does that sound familiar to you people who are worrying about the S&L bailout? With numerous enterprises, the state guaranteed a return on the capital invested. They guaranteed a return and assumed all the risk of investment losses. So the investor, the rich investor, didn't have to worry about any losses, and if his business didn't do well, he'd get the money from the state treasury in any way. This is why the capitalists did like fascism. This, however, did not really bring a final solution. What the fascist state is, it attempts a final solution to the problem of class conflict. It obliterates the demands of the working class and the democratic forms that allow workers some room for an organized defense of their interests. But this final solution proves very far from final. In fascist Italy and Germany, industrial sabotage and sporadic wildcat strikes continued, inflation increased, whole sectors of the economy remained stagnant, there was widespread corruption, mismanagement, underemployment, vital social services deteriorated, but profits climbed. The profits went up, yes sir. The gestures made on behalf of the needy were pitiful. What the Nazis used to do is go around in the working class areas and collect alms, so they taxed the poor to give money to the still poorer, as Franz Schumann once said. The Italian economy remained in a troubled, stagnant condition right up to the Second World War. In Germany, thanks to the booming armaments industry, the standard of living, at least most notably the unemployment problem, well, it had been so bad, that standard of living improved a little bit, but it never even reached, by the way, it never even reached what it was in 1933 under the Weimar Republic. It never reached 1928 levels. So even under the Weimar Republic, for all its troubles, the levels of food, textile, and other areas of consumption and production were much better than ever achieved under Nazi Germany. Anyone interested in reading more about fascism, I would direct you to a very fine book by Daniel Guérin, G-U-E-R-I-N, called Fascism and Big Business. The writings of Franz Neumann are also worth looking at. Now, my references on a couple of occasions here, I've made references to Reagan and Reaganism. I didn't mean to imply that Reagan was a fascist. In fact, quite the opposite. I meant to point out that in the American context, Reaganism met the same crisis that was going on, a similar crisis. It wasn't quite the same, but accomplished the same things within the existing framework, the political framework of the existing political system. He broke unions, but he didn't use death squads and terror squads. He broke them using consultation corporations, advisory corporations, spending hundreds of millions of dollars showing companies how to break unions. They broke unions by instituting one of the most restrictive and prohibitive and difficult laws, the Taft-Hartley Law, that one goes back to 1940s, which make union organizing in America so very difficult. They've tried a number of times to limit our constitutional rights, the rights of free speech, the right of government accountability. They've cut inheritance taxes. They've cut the capital gains taxes. They've cut corporate taxes. They've abolished the progressive income tax. These are the accomplishments of the Ronald Reagan administration. While everyone talked about what a nitwit and a dingbat and a fool he was, Ronald Reagan did some very successful and brilliant things for his class. He rolled back the social democracy that had been developing in the late 60s and through the 70s. He cut back undermined human services. He staffed agencies in courts with people in government who do not believe in government and do not even carry out the programs that Congress voted in. So within the American context, he's done quite a few things, short of what Hitler and Mussolini did as a final solution. And today I would also point out that in capitalist democracies in Western Europe and in the United States, the security forces have that same double standard that we discovered in Italy and in the Weimar Republic in Germany. Namely, they look the other way toward violence from the right, or seem to do very little, or seem seldom able to capture the perpetrators, unless the perpetrators are so crazy as to attack and kill police themselves. Then they go after them. But on the left, there's a constant surveillance, harassment, and in fact, sometimes outright murder. One can think of the systematic murder of the Black Panther Party, something like 30 of them killed in coordinated police attacks in cities throughout America. Or one can think of what's going on in West Germany, Italy, Belgium, Portugal today, where people on the left are being thrown in jail for astronomical sentences, while terrorists on the right seem to get by and get away with murder. Well, this is what we have to look at, and we have to understand that fascism is not just another ism out there. It's not just an aberration. It has a very rational side to it. It's a rational, functional form, and it can take diluted forms, and its propensities, its proclivities can exist even in the democratic state. That is, within that state, those police powers and those state powers can manifest some of the very same symptoms and all the worst attributes that you might find in a Nazi Germany or fascist Italy. Don't take my word for it, just ask the CIA. Thank you. This is Michael Parenti with some real history.
I'm going to tell all you fascists, you may be surprised. Hey, shoot fascist about. I'm going to this battle, take my Union gun. Gonna end this world of slavery, for this war is one you're bound to lose. You fascists are bound to lose. Are you fascists about to lose? You fascists about to lose. You fascists about to lose. You're about to lose. You fascists are bound.
When the generator's on, till the cops said move along.